Greetings, race community. Brent coming in live with today's guest, Bill Kavan, who serves as Vice President of Engagement and Outreach at the Arizona State University Foundation for a New American University, which is the longest title in the So congratulations on that, Bill, and welcome.
Well, thanks. Yeah, I didn't pick the title, but here we go. Good seeing you, and thanks for inviting me to participate.
No, happy to reconnect and excited to learn more about your journey. As I would say, having done a couple hundred of these interviews, it's relatively unique among advancement leaders, and you've got an interesting perspective that certainly links to my world and at the same time, a deep commitment to the sector. But before we get into all of that, why don't you take me back to junior year of high school? Who was that, Bill? What were you into, and what led you to Arizona State University?
Well, that's an interesting one. High school, I was on the track team, but I spent a lot of my time on my business. I had a landscaping business and started it, pulling a lawnmower on the back of my bike.
How old were you on the first job, the first day?
Probably about 10.
And where were you?
West Hampton Beach, New York.
So you're 10 years old. And you said, "Mom and Dad, I got to go to work."
Yep. Well, my dad had he had a business, and he had that ethic of, okay, I'm going to buy you Converse sneakers. If you want Nike, you got to pay the difference. So I started my little business and grew it into several employees and trucks and whatnot. And so dropped off the track team and focused more on that and became a little entrepreneur.
Did you get the Nikes, or you reinvested into the business?
Both. Started buying stocks back then too. So that was unique for like a 13-year-old. I had to go to my parents and say, "Hey, can you buy the stock?" Because they won't let me buy it.
They must have been really proud and maybe a little confused.
But it was an interesting area to grow up in. In the winter, there was no one there. In the summer, it was booming. And in the summer, everybody wanted to come out and have their weekend homes ready to go when they arrived. So they hired the neighbor kid to mow the lawn and trim the bushes and pick up the leaves and all that stuff.
Any favorite clients or particularly poignant memories from that period?
She actually grew to be a friend. She was in her 80s, and her family all lived away, and we became very, really good friends. And one Christmas, she decided she wasn't going to have a tree for the first time ever. So I and some of the people on my landscaping team asked her for the key to her house. And she reluctantly gave it to us, and we put a tree in her living room and decorated it. And so when she came home from midnight mass, there was a tree there for her. So she thought we were going to have a party, but I told her we're not having a party.
That sounds like a Christmas miracle. What a memory. Very cool.
But yeah, she, became one of my good friends, even though there was a, 60-year age difference.
Incredible. Sounds like an excellent training ground for advancement, relationship building, stewardship, you name it. There aren't a lot of kids that year who moved from Long Island to Arizona State University. So how did ASU get on your radar? That's a big move.
Yeah, well, I actually did 2 years at a community college because I wasn't sure what I want. I was thinking I was going to keep building this business. And my parents were like, "You need to go to college. So go to the community college, see if you like it, and then go from there." And I was just doing research because I did actually like college, and ended up getting rid of the business and going to college, and still here at ASU after.
But, I mean, it's one thing to maybe be on the fence about college at all, to then go to community college, enjoy the experience, and then decide to move across the country.
Yeah, I wanted to try something different because it was a small town. My family has lived on Long Island since 1640.
Wow.
And I wanted to try something different. And so looked out west, Texas, Arizona, California, And I think when I came to ASU, I knew that's where I wanted to go. I mean, it was diametrically opposite of where I grew up and my high school, and it just was a good fit for me.
And I know the Greek community was formative in many ways, both personally and professionally. Rumor has it you were the Arizona State University Fraternity Man of the Year in 1992.
That rumor would be true,
So
yes.
tell me about just the community college transition, the role that the Greek community played, and then how you sort of plugged in from a leadership perspective.
Yeah, when I came here, I didn't know anyone in the state of Arizona, really. And I wanted to get involved in something, you know, to have that kind of grounding with a community, because I was going from small to huge. My first class was larger than my entire graduating class in high school. So the Greek system was a way to kind of plug in and get involved, and ended up getting very engaged in philanthropy and Rush and things like that, and became president, and then got involved with the Greek IFC, Interfraternity Council, and got involved with my international fraternity as a undergrad kind of advisor to other chapters. So yeah, it had a very impactful experience, and I'm still engaged. And I'm actually this weekend going to one of my fraternity brothers owns a lake house in Illinois, and flying back there and meeting a bunch of other guys. And kind of randomly, another one of our fraternity brothers owns a house on the same private lake, so it will be like a little mini reunion. But yeah, that led to the first job out of college, which was working for my fraternity as a chapter advisor. And through that experience, I kind of liked the alumni part of it and the fundraising aspect of it. So that kind of laid the groundwork for my career.
And so tell me about that kind of first couple of years out of college. What was the role? What were you focused on? Key mentors or memories?
I would say with the fraternity, that was the first year out of college. It's a 1 year kind of consultancy where you go and you visit chapters and whatnot. And I got to meet some really interesting people. We had a fraternity event at the White House because at the time, President Bush and Vice President Quayle are both fraternity brothers. And so I got to go and meet them at the White House, and that was pretty unique. And as far as mentors, I mean, I think I had a lot. There were people still at ASU that I would refer back to. The Greek life advisor was one. I'm still in contact with her. But yeah, I just loved the kind of networking and interaction and philanthropy piece of there are people who are giving money that are supporting other people that they've never met before. You know, like I did get a scholarship when I was a student, never met the donor. The donor had been deceased. And so that in combination with, you know, receiving funding to help go to fraternity convention and other things, just kind of got me thinking more and more about, you know, what I wanted to do when I grow up. And so I left the fraternity job after the year, and you know, I could have moved back to New York. I could have stayed in Michigan where the job was, but I wanted to get back to Arizona, and ASU in particular. And didn't end up getting a job at ASU. Worked for the National MS Society, and did a lot of work there, on, you know, basically kind of entry level event kind of fundraising, volunteer work, et cetera, which kind of played into my experience that I had with the fraternity. And then I still was a volunteer at ASU in hopes of one day working at ASU.
And so, what led to the pivot to software technology, PeopleSoft, sort of the dot-com boom is starting? That's a big shift.
It was. So back to the whole networking thing, right? I was at a fraternity convention, as an alum. It was the 150th celebration of our fraternity, and I happened to be seated at a table with a gentleman who owned a software company in Phoenix, and he had started Information Associates many years before, which turned into SCT, which then turned into SunGard. But he was starting a new company, and he asked what I did, and I said, I work in fundraising. He's like, oh, we're going to be building fundraising software as part of the overall package. And so we talked a little while, and I came back to Phoenix and ended up applying for that position that he was talking about, and worked there for a while. That company got bought by PeopleSoft, and that's how I got into software. I was very, very young, green, and I didn't have, I wasn't very seasoned professional in fundraising. I obviously had a lot of experience, but not, 10, 15 years. I was like
Right.
4 years out of college.
But when you joined PeopleSoft, and I guess it was by way of acquisition, I mean, this was 97, 98. It was one of the best places to work. It was an absolute rocket ship. I read at one point it was described as like Silicon Valley rocket ship meets adult summer camp or something like that. I think you got that vibe, but it just sounds really, really unique.
PeopleSoft was a unique place. Dave Duffield was the founder of the company, and interestingly enough, Dave Duffield and the fraternity brother of mine that I met were the ones who founded Information Associates. And then they
Amazing.
both went off in different directions, and then
That's
they kind
awesome.
of came back, years later.
So tell me more about just the exposure he had there. Sort of a legendary guy. One of the I know culture or mottos was like, it's mandatory we have fun here. If I'm not mistaken, he was like in a rock band, like literally at the company.
The Raving Daves.
Raving Daves. So maybe you've seen them play. And then I
I
don't know
have
if
their
the
CD
culture.
if you would. I could get you a copy of the CD if you want
We might need to see if
it.
we can find some footage and splice it into this part of the episode. So we'll see what our producer can come up with. But at the same time, it was all, I mean, it was literally like, I guess when you hear work hard, play hard, it's sort of cliche. There's a rumor that at one all staff meeting, 300 employees all jumped into a hotel pool at 4 a.m. For example, I don't know if that's true, but like work hard, play
That would
hard.
be true because I was there. Yes. That was the first. So going from a small software company in Phoenix to getting acquired by this behemoth public company that, like you said, was a rocket ship. The team that I was on was the only team that they had acquired. So they only hired the advancement team. That was working on the development software. And we were invited to go to a PeopleSoft convention. And we show up and we're at the PeopleSoft staff hotel. And it's, like hundreds of people out by the pool, hanging out, whatever. And but then you're, 8 in the morning at the convention, working sessions and talking to people and moving things forward.
Yeah.
And that was it was an interesting time because we had built some software that the University of Colorado was using. And then when we went with PeopleSoft, they had developed a development group, advisory group to help with the advancement software. And then we're dealing with Cornell, we're dealing with SMU and other
Yep.
institutions who are part of this development group. And that was eye-opening, coming from, my development experience was more, I did work at U of A, University of Arizona for a time. I know my Sun Devil people don't like that. Neither do the Wildcats, but I worked there for a year. I worked at a community college for about a year and a half. So then getting exposure to a Cornell and an SMU and some of the larger, more sophisticated organizations, it was really good experience to see that.
And at the same time, if there's one constant around software and tech, it's sort of been the volatility, right? If you think of higher ed as a relatively maybe stable, consistent industry, right? Tech is maybe the polar opposite. And so you kind of caught that dot-com boom wave,
Yeah.
all the excess that went along with it, but then also lived through what had to be a pretty sobering experience just through the dot-com crash. And you probably don't want to reflect on that part of your career, but like it was,
Well, I mean, it was still from the higher ed software aspect of it. I mean, even in the early 2000s, people were still implementing, they still needed the software. Now, the companies as a whole weren't doing what they were doing previously. But, from an advancement perspective, I was always still busy. I was always still in demand. And I got recruited out of the PeopleSoft world into one of the implementation partners. So then I was working on site with Cornell and other institutions to get the software up and running and used. So I kind of have the software development side, the implementation side. So it was a unique trifecta of experiences.
So within the broader, let's call it dot-com crash, there was stability and tailwinds, just given that higher ed was in this early phase of just digitization. And I meet people still who talk about when they went from the file cabinets with the
Oh,
darn
yeah.
files, and you probably helped turn that into right digital experiences for the first time.
Well, at the community college that I worked at, literally there was no software. Like, it was all Excel spreadsheets. It was student information system from when students graduated in 1968 or 1972 or whenever they graduated. And, we were trying to piece together the first kind of development program for this community college. The president had the idea of fundraising through events. And then I had to kind of come in as this 24-year-old and go, yeah, we should do that as part of a broader plan,
Yeah.
annual giving, estate and gift planning, the whole major gift piece. And doing that without software was a challenge. And without current addresses for our alums.
And so as you advanced through your software leadership, you ended up, and I don't know the exact merger, acquisition, organic, how it all happened, but you joined SunGard, and you were a part of the higher ed division there that ultimately became Ellucian for those listening who have familiarity with Ellucian products. And I remember that time, Bill, because I started Evertrue in 2010, and that's when I was just sort of canvassing the market, trying to learn and research and reading investment reports. And I'm sure, at some point at that 2011, 12 period, I'm sure I probably was cold emailing you trying to get on your radar,
Possibly,
because
yeah.
we were just trying to learn this whole landscape. And Ellucian grew into such a leader. And I know it was a kind of a convoluted story, but just what do you reflect on from that time?
Well, that was actually one of my favorite jobs because I, BSR at the time was always like the product. You had Harvard, Stanford, all the big sophisticated organizations using BSR Advance. And then BSR then got acquired by SunGard. And I
I
was
just have to comment, like one of the very first people I met when I was doing my research, I went down to Brown, my alma mater, and they humored me and sort of met with their team, and it ended up being incredibly supportive. But I met a guy named Tony Allison,
Oh, yeah,
who
yeah.
was super early, and he told me about he was like one of the first people that just gave me the landscape of BSR to SunGard to Ellucian, et cetera.
Yeah. He had worked at BSR for a long time. He and Fred Weiss, and Michael Westerkamp and Donna Fredolino were kind of like the core of BSR. And then the owner of BSR sold to SunGard, and it got kind of brought in. And then SunGard had the portfolio of three advancement solutions. You had advanced for kind of the larger, more sophisticated. Then you had kind of the banner advancement that was more for integrated solution, institutions that didn't want to mess around with integration with advance. And then Power Campus advancement, which would have been, I would have loved to have had at the community college that I worked at, Central Arizona College, because it actually was just basics, bread and butter type tracking, CRM tracking. But it was a great experience to work with, all of those institutions that Advance had and that Banner Advancement had, and working with Fred and Donna and some of the other individuals who, I consider kind of like legendary in the advancement space, building a partnership at the time with iModules, which was kind of the hot new tool on the marketplace, working with data
Honestly,
visualization.
Bill, I was so jealous of them and the relationship you all had, and it was just an example of partnership and integration. And yeah, I got to know Fred, who ultimately went on to lead iModules, and then the founding team, the Palmers at iModules as well. But yeah, that was an absolute just incredible case study and kind of moment for the industry.
Yeah, and like you said, there are ebbs and flows. Like Advance used to be the tool, and then for a while there it was flipping more to Blackbaud. And I would say now I don't know that there's a clear leader in the CRM space. You have AffiniQuest and you have Ascend. But I don't see, like there's not a, and there's still people on Advance. There's still
Yep.
people on Blackbaud. There's still, it's not as clear a market as I would say it once was.
Yeah, no, there was clear, call it consolidation or leadership at that point. And yeah, between let's call it the Ellucium systems, the Blackbaud systems, Slate, even in your backyard, Virtuous,
Yeah.
Kindsight, AffiniQuest, there's sort of more options than ever, which is interesting because it's not as if the market is expanding, right? We're not adding lots and lots of universities that need enterprise CRMs. So it certainly feels more crowded than maybe it's ever been on the CRM layer.
Yeah, and I will give Fred, who I reported to, props when we were there, and I was reporting to him as the vice president for strategy for the advancement solutions, and he was talking about Salesforce, and we've got to work with Salesforce and build that kind of layer like AffiniQuest and Ascend have done, and Ellucian kind of went in a different path. But I think that was very visionary at the time. And I think some people couldn't even wrap their head around, like, what? Like, you have Salesforce and then you have a application on top of it. And now between the multiple products that lay on top of Salesforce, they are a big player in the space.
Yeah, no doubt. And I think in general, a broader theme is just open architecture, interoperability, kind of moving out of the more closed system. So it's sort of from where we sit, we've always been a CRM agnostic tool. And so we just kind of have to watch where the
Yeah.
market's going and then figure out, how to get data in and out and sort of let the customers decide, right, what is best for them and then just try to be a part of it, right, regardless of those underlying decisions. But like you have this really unique sort of start in the advancement in Greek field, let's call it. You pivot into technology, the intersection of higher education and technology, and then we're able to kind of come full circle back to ASU, achieve that early career
Yeah.
dream of finally getting hired there. So somebody came around. But like, did you apply? Were you recruited? Just tell me about
I
that.
had always been involved with ASU, and luckily PeopleSoft, SunGard, they were all based somewhere else, but I was a remote employee. I was, like that was also pretty unique in the late 90s and 2000s, where I was kind of like pre-COVID, right? Like I was doing all the things when people were like freaking out here about COVID and having to work at home. I'm like, you're gonna love it. You can get just as much done, maybe more. So luckily, because of that, I was able to still volunteer with ASU, and I was engaged on various committees and boards and whatnot, and ended up becoming the chair of the Alumni Association for a term. And that's more like a 3 year, because you're chair elect, chair, and then past chair. So that was a seminal moment for me, because I then got even more ingrained with ASU, and I've always been passionate about it, but became even more passionate about it. And then about a year after my past chair term ended, there was a position open in the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences to essentially rebuild that team. And I'm an alum of the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences. And so I reached out and basically just said, like, is this wired for somebody, or, is this really an open position? And it was open, and so I was kind of like the last person to apply and kind of the dark horse. I hadn't been like a true frontline fundraiser in years. I had been volunteer fundraising and other things, but I was more the software guy. That's how most people knew me at ASU, because ASU was a client as well. And so went through the whole gauntlet of interviewing, which here is pretty intense, especially for a that level of position, leading the largest college's development team. So, the dean and everybody in the foundation, and people all throughout the college. And fortunately, I was given the position, and it was a position that was new, which would sound surprising to most people, because when the financial market tanked in 2008, the dean, the then dean of the college, decided to eliminate the development team. And the foundation basically had, one person kind of helping out, doing what they could for the college. So fundraising went, as you would imagine, went down significantly. With it, to put it in perspective, the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences at ASU is larger than the entire University of Oregon. From a student perspective, from an alum perspective, but not from a
Essentially,
budget.
imagine the University of Oregon without a fundraising team.
Right? Yeah.
Seems like a missed opportunity.
Very much so. So a new dean was brought in, and is like, that was one of his big goals, was we need to rebuild this. And this is not something that we can continue with, and we have to invest and move forward. So I was hired, and then I had to, basically build the structure, develop staff, hire staff, get budget. It took a little while, because you can't just hire a bunch of people. You don't have the one, you don't have the pool of people to bring in, and two, you don't have the budget to do that. And I had to prove that, building the team and investing in the team was going to change the trajectory of the numbers.
It sounds like a uniquely entrepreneurial kind of role and opportunity within the higher ed advancement landscape. Were there specific milestones you hit where you started getting that evidence or proof point that you could take to leadership or the board to secure more resources?
Yeah, that was definitely the case. We had to build out, well, NGC obviously is the big one, but also how many people are we touching, and what's the what are the other KPIs, visits and contact reports, and I actually implemented Net Promoter Score to kind of see, has the tone of our base changed over a period of time? And so slowly then we start building out the team. And now when I left, we got it up to about 10 people, which is still low. But ASU is a very unique entity, and we run thin on staff. Not just fundraising staff, but staff overall, at the university. So we do a lot with a little. And now the college went from about 7 million a year, and we're probably in the, depending on the year, I would say on average, we're probably in the 30, 35 million range.
And so, when you think about that kind of growth and doing it with real budget constraints, right? There wasn't just money falling off trees to go and do this stuff. Like, are there generalizable lessons that you would share with our audience that are likely ways almost every organization could drive efficiency?
I think there's a couple things. Well, one, I tried to be creative about using resources that are already in place. So in one instance, we had a staff member, and I was able to get half their time to work with us and then half their time on something else. I also, we have a foundation because we're a public entity. And then we have university. So we have two buckets of money. And so I was able to get the foundation to kick in some of the money. And then the university was kicking in some of the money. And then I started doing that with other units within the college to try to cobble together enough money to get resources together. I think some of the other things is leveraging some of the communication resources that we had that were already existing in the college, but we weren't leveraging for a development purpose. Welcome week, our alumni newsletter, that really, when I started, it didn't have anything about alumni or development or anything in it. And it was like, how do we infuse some of these things that you're already doing, but how do we infuse a development and a philanthropy angle to it? Like, when we're doing a news story now, I always ask, can we put an insert at the bottom that is a link to, if you want to support something like this, go to here, or if you want to support this exact fund, go here. And also kind of going out to building those relationships across campus. In the college, it was 40 units within the college. So schools, departments, institutes, centers, some of them had no clue about philanthropy and how they could help us and how we could help them.
That has to be one of the biggest challenges and opportunities in a role like that, the balance of the fact that you've got a constituency larger than the University of Oregon that is not being engaged, but at the same time you've got all of those internal stakeholders. Like, how do you balance your time external versus internal? That has to be a real challenge.
Yeah, it is a balancing act, right? You can't spend all your time internal, but if the internal resources are helping you connect with the external resources, like faculty, chairs, that have connections with some of these alums that could help us. And we developed several new boards and advisory groups through referrals from faculty members, et cetera. I mean, this isn't rocket science, but it's actually, you have to have the people to be able to do it. And at the time, there was no one who was there to do it.
When you
And
think
so,
about like that journey, whether it's personal experiences or partnership with deans and others, like were there any like what are some of the more poignant memories where you just felt like it was working, whether a specific gift was secured or there was some sort of cross-functional collaboration that wouldn't have happened in the, in the preceding time?
I think there's a couple instances. One would be creating an advisory board for one of our centers. And they had an endowment, and it was spinning off a certain amount of money, and they were doing kind of the little, and didn't like me at first because they wanted to name scholarships for someone who was giving $250. And I'm like, we are undercutting ourselves. And, we ended up instituting a naming policy because of that. And so anyway, we started this advisory group. It was named after the center was named after a donor. They had not given since the endowment. So it kind of spurred them on to get more engaged, and I developed a very strong relationship with them. They became, kind of chairs emeritus of the group. They leveraged their community of friends and associates from business, et cetera. And so we kind of built out a broader pool. And then it still is going on. And I've been gone from the college now for 8 years or so. And still I'm connected with them. I still donate to that group just because I feel passionate about it. And it's a kind of a niche area. And it's now one of the big discretionary revenue sources for this center beyond the endowment. And so I think that was successful, and it did not take a lot of time or resources to actually do that, but it was more discussing with the director what possibilities there were.
Tell me about the current role, VP of Engagement and Outreach. What does that mean? You've got a massive, growing community. Tell me about the current scope.
Yeah, so it's a interesting position that I think does leverage a lot of my skills. So we've got and the synergies among teams too. So we have annual giving within engagement outreach. So reaching out to the masses through all the various channels that we have. And then donor relations and engagement is also part of the team. So we've built that team out and are trying to, again, kind of use those synergies between donor engagement, donor relations and engagement, and annual giving to move forward our metrics. The digital donor engagement and services group, which I'm sure you would appreciate, that team focuses on how do we leverage all of our digital resources to better engage with our donors and our prospects, mainly donors. Also have the scholarship advancement team. So an area that I'm passionate about, but it's a group that not only raises money for scholarships, but helps the units and advises them on setting up scholarships so we don't have scholarships that are not within the policies, procedures, laws that we need to adhere to. Also have what we call donor sorry, we might need to edit this part.
No worries, no worries. Yeah.
Engagement and outreach development. which is the team that focuses on, I would call it more leadership annual giving. And so they are working on President's Club, Women in Philanthropy, Mirabella, which is unique to ASU, a retirement community right on campus, 20 story tower that we have high net worth individuals living there.
You have over 600,000 members of your alumni community.
Yes, we do.
So I know you've indicated that sort of engagement at scale is maybe the panacea, the holy grail of the industry. You are in a unique spot where you literally have to try to deliver on that. I would think that it would make sort of data intelligence, like how do you go from 600,000 to even 60,000 or 6,000 potential relationships? And we've come a long way from the files at the community college. So I'm just curious sort of where you feel like there's been material progress and also maybe the biggest missed opportunities from where you sit today.
Well, I think for us, there's always opportunities just because there's so many people that we could be reaching out to. I think one of the first things is the data and the integrity of the data. Because if we don't have their right email, their right phone number, to a lesser extent, address, it doesn't matter that we have 600,000, because if we can only reach 20,000, we have a much smaller pool. So we're always working on that and always trying to keep that data updated, because people are changing jobs and changing emails, and it's not like it was back in, even in the 90s, where people are so fluid. Now, with emails, there's a lot cheaper way to communicate, and texting and various things like that. But then you have added layers of complexity related to texting, with the various rules related to texting, and opt-ins and opt-outs, et cetera.
I think we can agree at this point that the channel, like a new channel, is never going to be the fix, right? Like people thought once we can email people, then, well, that's going to make everything better. And it does. But then also everyone else in every other industry can email those same people. And then I think there was clearly in the early 2010s, it was all about texting and texting. And once we can text people, it's like, well, guess what? Now we can't hardly look away from our phones without spam texts, you know. Happening, and so it just gets noisy, right? And so I think it's like the channels will continue to evolve, but it's not going to change the fact that if you want to stand out, it's got to be relevant, it's got to be personalized, it's got to be authentic, or else it's just noise.
And I am 100% on board with what you just said. I look at it as an ecosystem, because we need to know Brent wants text and Bill wants email and Mary wants direct mail. And kind of to your point, the personalization aspect of it. I think one of the things that we have done that I'm pretty excited about and proud of is some of the journeys that we've built and communicating with people, because I would say we had not done a very good job of expressing gratitude, impact, appreciation on a regular basis. It was more of that, okay, time's up, let's ask them again, versus communicating and trying to understand what they want to hear about. And we've built a bunch of journeys. And so, like, if you're a first time donor, you get on the first time donor journey and you go through these various communications, and then you drop into our ongoing donor engagement series communications. And we try to make those fun, relevant to who we're sending it to. But then we have different journeys for young alums. We have different journeys for parents. We have different journeys for various different segments to try to provide that relevant content to them.
We're living through this generative AI transformation, and you can't really ignore it at this point. It's sort of everywhere, every news article, every headline, every conference. We just did a webinar yesterday. It was about this topic. And what's your take? I mean, you've lived through some other waves. Is it hype? Is it reality? Somewhere in between? And what do
I
you?
mean, I think it's not hype. I think it's we just have to figure out how to use it to advance what we're want to do. Like we are moving forward with a pilot, so to speak, with a digital engagement officer that's AI based. It's a pilot because we want to see how it works and the, but in our case, with the volume that we have, we will never hire enough people. So that's what I always talk about, like how do we do this at scale? That still people feel like they are engaged with ASU. We're not going to get everyone to come back for homecoming. That's just not going to happen. We're not going to have people coming to events and whatnot. So we have to figure out how to do that. And I will say we have an added interesting layer that we're still trying to figure out is how do you deal with alums who have never set foot on campus?
Right. And that group is growing quickly. And I happy to discuss it. I've known Adam Martell a long time. He's leading Givesy. We spent a bunch of time together recently, and it's a polarizing topic right now. There's a lot of pilots happening. And what I've said to him and what I would say to this community is like, we need entrepreneurs trying new things and taking risks and attempting new approaches to get at engagement at scale, as you're describing. We certainly have our perspective and approaches in that regard. Givesy's got theirs, and what's very clear, what I've said to Adam, what I love about that focus and the model is it's either going to work or it's not. It's going to be unequivocal in the data. There's not going to be opinion. Right now we're living in the opinion phase because it's so new. But folks like you are going to run pilots, and we're going to find out that it unlocks authentic relationship building and philanthropy at scale, or
It
it doesn't,
doesn't.
and it ends up being another thing in our inbox that is hard to stand out. I don't know. We'll find out, and I'm excited for the industry to find out. Which I suspect, even we're recording this on July 30th of 2025. I think by July 30th, 2026, we're going to know a lot more.
And I would say AI, not just that aspect of it, but using it to better segment audiences, using it to help draft better letters, endowment reports, analyzing data. Like there's a lot of areas that we're already using it.
I mean, one of the areas we're incredibly excited about, for example, Evertrue, we have a solution called Balance. It was started by a company called Fundriver. It does endowed fund and endowed and restricted fund accounting, right? After the donor makes the gift, the money has to be invested and managed and then reported out on and spent to help a kid, right? Or help a program. But as we've looked into that data set, like there are hundreds, thousands of funds in some cases already established at a given university. That meanwhile, if I'm a fundraiser and I'm trying to figure out what Brent or Bill might be interested in, I have virtually no ability to cross-reference this donor profile, this set of historical engagement or gift transactions or the tickets that they bought, like all of those breadcrumbs can paint a composite of a donor that then when referenced against fund purpose descriptions or the original memos of understanding between the donor and the university, like all of a sudden you can be like, oh, there's three funds that already exist that could be an amazing fit for Bill. I, as a fundraiser, had no idea they existed. Bill, as a donor, definitely didn't know they existed. Now we can sort of fast forward to like relevant impact driven discussions in a way that up until now, it's sort of been manual, asking around, hey, Bill, are we doing anything around exploration? You know, like that conversation should be, I hope, radically streamlined through this technology.
My hope is that AI helps us do our job better in all areas, like the area that you just discussed, that's another application, but there's so many applications to AI and helping us do our job better. I think people worry too much about like, oh, it's going to take our job. Like, it is not, like people, someone is not going to give ASU $100 million because some AI agent reached out to it or to the person.
I think you know, that kind of philanthropy will be the last to go, right? If everything gets AI'd away, who knows, maybe someday. But for now, my hope, I share what you just stated, which is there's this quote that's gone around. We've shared it, Harvard Business Review. You know, AI won't replace humans, but humans with AI will replace humans without AI. And I think that's what we're starting to see in this sector, is there is this fluency gap emerging quickly. There are people that are leaning into these tools and technologies at all levels of the organizations that are developing the fluency and are finding ways in every part of the work, from planning the event to creating the list to doing the segmentation to creating the copy to hitting send. They're doing it faster and better than ever before. And other people are doing it like they were in 2021. And that gap is going to create tremendous opportunity for the folks that lean into it and develop that fluency and do pilots like the one you're doing.
No, we're ASU number one in innovation 10
No
years in a
doubt.
row,
Yeah, you have no
and
choice. You guys have to do this stuff. If
yeah,
you're not doing it, who's
like
doing it?
Dr. Crow wants to know what are we innovating on, what's next?
You guys have Dr. Crow wants to know shirts.
That would be a good idea.
That's all right. I'll see what we can do. So I know we're kind of coming up on time here, but I know I see over 20 positions open right now at the ASU Foundation Careers page. So what should folks listening know about the foundation and the opportunities right now?
Well, I would say, yeah, it's a great place to work. I'm now going on my 14th year as an employee. And I always tell people I've been around since 1988, either as a student, a volunteer, or a staff member. But it's a special place. And, to me, it all reverts back to the charter, which is very different than a lot of institutions. Like we are trying to fuse access and excellence at the same time. So educating as many people as possible. The democratization of education is what we're trying to do. And whether that's immersion students or online or hybrid, we are, I don't know what we're going to be next year, but we're about 180,000 students right now. I'm inspired every day by coming here because I hear, like I have a unique lens because I get to meet a lot of these students. I get to meet a lot of the faculty. And when I read some of the stories for our impact summaries and I hear what these students are doing, it blows me away. I'm bullish on the future. Because of, when I'm interacting with these students and hearing what their thoughts are and what they're working on and what their goals are. Arizona, like I said, I moved from New York to Arizona, very different. You're an East Coast guy. I love it out here. I don't love it is, you said July 30th. I don't love the summers here. You deal with 3 months of warm weather. Some would call it extremely hot weather. But the rest of the year is perfect for hiking and outdoor activities. And come on out to Arizona, take a visit.
I'm going to start looking at dates from October 1st forward, if that sounds okay to
And
you.
we do have a football team. So, if you come out, let me know. get you to watch a good game.
love it, Phil. I
We're not
love
playing Brown though, sorry.
it. I feel pretty good about that, in fact. Anyway, look, thank you for the time and the journey from the 10-year-old entrepreneur to now. It's great to know you better, and it's why I love having these episodes, because I've seen you for years, and feel like I know you a little bit better, and I know our community does too. So thank you for sharing the
Well,
journey. I
great.
wish you could bottle up some of that, 10-year-old entrepreneurial spirit and work ethic and grit that your parents instilled, and I think we could sell that for a good price out there these days. But
Well, I still feel like I'm an entrepreneur. Like in ASU, you have to be an entrepreneur. You have to figure out how to get things done, and that's why it's a fascinating and exciting place to work.
well, I'm going to be talking about you at the dinner table tonight with my 11-year-old and 9-year-old boys.
All
See if
right, get them out there mowing lawns, or maybe something with AI,
they want the Nikes, they have to.
All
I love it, Bill. Thank you so much. And
right,
with
thanks.
that, I'm going to wrap up today's episode featuring Bill Kavan, who serves as Vice President of Engagement and Outreach at Arizona State University Foundation for a New American University, which, if you're wondering, is 110 characters in that full job title.
All
Thanks, Bill, and take
right.
care, everybody.